Hello, I'm Annalisa Van Hook. Welcome to the Science Translational Medicine podcast for January 20th, 2016. In this show, I'll be speaking with Sonia Minical-Vallib and Eric Vallib-Minical from the Broad Institute of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Harvard. They're authors on a paper about the prevalence of genetic variants associated with prion diseases. Prion diseases are neurodegenerative disorders that are caused by misfolding of the prion protein, which is encoded by the PRNP gene. These diseases are rare, but they're fatal and genetically dominant. Only a very small portion of prion disease cases are caused by ingestion of animal products that contain the misfolded prion proteins that cause transmissible spongiform encephalopathies like mad cow disease and scraping. Instead, most cases are either sporadic or associated with specific variants of the PRNP gene. Vallib and Minical were part of a large team that surveyed human PRNP sequences to determine how prevalent these variant alleles are in the population. Eric and Sonia are joining us now to tell us more. Eric and Sonia, welcome to the Science Translational Medicine Podcast.
Thank you.
Hi.
Great to be here.
Good to be here.
I know that you have a very personal connection to this story, so I'd like to start off with that. Would you mind telling our listeners why you've become so interested in the PRNP gene variants?
Sure. So Eric and I are actually a married couple. We're a husband-wife scientific team, and this is a second career for both of us. We actually changed careers to work on therapeutics for human prion disease after learning that I carry a disease-causing mutation in the prion protein gene. So our long-term interest is in working on drugs for these diseases, which are currently fatal and untreatable. However, one of our first questions upon receiving my genetic test report was, we know that this mutation is associated with disease. We know that it caused the disease that killed my mother. But how likely is it, given that I have this mutation, that this will happen to me? And how much can we actually foresee of my future based on knowing that I have this mutation? And it turns out that the answers in the literature, especially for rare disease, weren't especially good. So we have a certain amount of data, but historically, the people who have had their prion protein gene sequenced are patients having prion disease or being from a family where prion disease has been seen. And that leaves a sort of missing half of the picture, which is how common are these mutations in the general population, and what can that tell us about the odds of developing the disease if you have a mutation?
Many variant alleles of PRNP have been described. Do all of those variants cause disease, or are all of those variants associated with disease?
Sonia and I looked in the literature, and we found 63 different genetic mutations in the prion protein gene that have been reported as causing disease. Now, for some of those, there's pretty good evidence. A lot of people have gotten sick. There's families where, you know, every generation people get sick with the same mutation, the same disease. Some of those genetic mutations were only ever seen in one patient. So we really have very little information on how bad those mutations are. In fact, we don't even know if they cause the disease or if it's just a coincidence that someone who happened to get the disease happened to have this genetic mutation as well. So when we look across these 63 different genetic mutations, there's some where we're really not sure if it causes the disease at all. And then there's others where there's strong evidence that it's associated with disease, but we still don't know the penetrance. So penetrance is the probability of developing the disease if you have the mutation. And historically, all the ways we've had of estimating penetrance have been based on a little bit of circular reasoning. So we'll look at a family where everybody gets sick, we do some DNA sequencing, we find a genetic mutation, now we've discovered the cause of the disease. But if we then turn around and ask, well, how many people with the mutation get the disease, there's a circularity there that always left us a little bit unsatisfied with the answers we'd seen in the literature.
So how did you go about addressing these questions?
Some of these questions have been hard to answer in the past just because we didn't have sequencing data on controls, members of the general population who haven't been selected for having prion disease. But that has started to really change, and we were really lucky to be able to take on this question with Daniel MacArthur. And this was a project spearheaded by Eric using the data from the Exome Aggregation Consortium, which is a consortium Daniel has been pulling together of exome data from tens of thousands of individuals. So at the time this analysis was done, it was about 60,000 exomes from people who were not selected based on having prion disease, and in fact not for having any neurodegenerative disease or neurological disease. And so we were able to look across this relatively unbiased data set for the frequency of variants in the prion protein gene. In addition, we were able to collaborate with 23andMe, who have data on a number of different PRNP variants in more than 500,000 individuals who had consented to participate in research.
From your analysis, what did you conclude about PRNP gene variants?
What we found is that the different variants in PRNP seem to occupy a spectrum of how bad they are. So for some of these variants that had only been seen in, you know, one or two patients, we found that they're actually reasonably common in control populations, which is something we wouldn't have been able to see before because we just didn't have enough data on controls. But it now seems that some of these are variants that either might confer a small amount of risk for this disease or are completely benign, completely neutral. And it just happened to be the case that someone got prion disease and had this genetic variant. So that's one end of the spectrum. Then there's some variants that do increase prion disease risk, but they're not quite what we would call a Mendelian disease variant. You know, they don't cause it 100% of the time. So we found a variant that we think gives you about a 0.1% lifetime risk of developing the disease, another variant that gives you a 1% lifetime risk. Now, that's a lot more than in the general population, where we think that only about 1 in 5,000 or 1 in 10,000 people ever dies of these diseases. But from a genetic counseling standpoint, it's still very low risk. And so for some of these people, this is a big change in the prognosis that they've been given. And then at the other end of the spectrum are some variants that we think really do cause disease close to 100% of the time. And unfortunately, that includes Sonia's mutation in that category.
How do you think this information can help practitioners in the clinic?
So the information that we've talked about so far in terms of understanding that some of these variants are more common than they should be in the general population if they're always causing disease, therefore they don't always, and in fact, they might be very low risk factors, they might be benign. We hope that that will immediately impact how a handful of individuals are being counseled genetically about their risk of developing prion disease. And for some people who've been told you have a variant in this gene that's been reported as pathogenic, therefore there's 100% lifetime risk, for some people that will fall dramatically to, as Eric was saying, maybe 1% lifetime risk, which makes a huge difference for them. It's probably not what they're going to die of. So that's where we hope the immediate impact will be. One other insight that came out of this study is that there's a therapeutic strategy that people have been curious about and interested in for a while, which is, could we reduce the amount of prion protein? And we know from animal models that if animals have less prion protein, then the time to prion disease, if you infect them with prions, is extended. So you can delay onset by reducing the amount of protein. However, we had never seen previously people with less than normal levels of prion protein. And so we didn't actually know from human data whether it's safe to reduce amounts of prion protein. We don't know its native function. And so there have always been skeptics as to whether that would be a viable and safe therapeutic strategy. And in this data set, we were able to identify three individuals who have one copy of their gene basically inactivated, meaning that they have, we assume, 50% of normal prion protein levels. And these individuals were older and they were healthy. So that gives us the first human validation that a therapeutic that could reduce the levels of prion protein might not only be hopefully effective, but also safe.
Sonia and Eric, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Sonia Minical-Vallab and Eric Vallab-Minical from the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. You can read their paper in the January 20th issue of Science Translational Medicine by going to our website at stm.sciencemag.org. I'm Annalisa Van Hook. Thanks for listening. This podcast is a production of Science Translational Medicine and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, working together to advance science and serve society.